You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings and happy Friday. Excuse me, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Boy, is it hot. And the job numbers are out today. Let's check in with Bernie and find out what's going on. It's the first hour of our program. It's our national town hall meeting. Senator Bernie Sanders will be taking your calls in just a few minutes here at 866-987-THOM. Hey, Bernie, how's everything in Vermont? Bernie? Oh, I got to push the button. I'm sorry. Senator, my apologies.
All right.
I had forgotten that we were doing this on the telephone.
And I'm back in Vermont, and it's really great to be back here for a week. It's a lot of fun.
Great. So your thoughts on the job numbers that came out and...
Well, the job numbers are not good. If you calculate, add in those people who are living in high unemployment areas who have given up looking for work and those people who are working part-time when they want to work full-time, what you're really talking about is unemployment of close to 15%, and that is disaster. And if you look at it, young people, people of color, the numbers are much higher than that. And it just speaks to the fact that while our Republican friends obstruct, the reality is we have got to be very, very aggressive in creating the millions of jobs that this country desperately needs. Now, the good news is that last week we passed a very modest, but we did pass it, a transportation bill, which will maintain, keep well over a million jobs and create another million jobs. But it was nowhere near as much as we have to do. That bill was focused. It was a two-year bill. Focused on, it was 27 months actually, focused on roads, which certainly need a lot of attention, bridges, which need a lot of attention, and public transportation. But there's so much more in infrastructure that we have to deal with. We have to deal with rail. We have to deal with water systems, with wastewater plants, with cell phone service, broadband, deteriorating schools. But we made a start. The Republicans in the House dragged their feet. I think we lost some of the construction season as a result of that, but at least we did finally get that passed. But bottom line is we need, in my view, to create millions of jobs, and one way you do that is by rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure. And when we do that, we can create a whole lot of jobs. I think in many parts of the country, people are now getting a glimpse of what global warming looks like. You're seeing these terrible, terrible forest fires and dryness in Colorado. You're seeing drought in the Midwest, which is going to drive up the price of food. You're seeing extreme weather disturbances. And meanwhile, back in the halls of Congress, we have one political party that refuses to acknowledge what virtually all scientists agree on, that global warming is real, that global warming is significantly man-made, and that global warming is already causing billions and billions of dollars in damage in our country and all over the world. And we're seeing that right now, up front, big time. And yet we can't even get a serious debate about acknowledging global warming, let alone how you proceed. But as I have pointed out many times, as we move toward transforming our energy system away from fossil fuels like coal and oil, into sustainable energy like wind, solar, geothermal, and biomass. As we move forward in terms of energy efficiency, getting cars that get 55 miles per gallon on average, which we will in the year 2025, rather than where we're at right now. As you weatherize buildings so that we, both in terms of maintaining heat and coolness for air conditioning, you not only help us, we move forward in the battle to reverse global warming, but we also create millions more jobs. So protecting the environment is a job creator, in my view. And lastly, in terms of jobs, it is astounding to me, Tom, you and I have talked about this for years. Despite all of the evidence about our unfettered free trade policies, we still have virtually every Republican and many Democrats who say, yeah, let's keep it going. Let's more unfettered free trade. We've only lost 60,000 factories in the last 10 years. I guess we can do even better than that. Let's throw millions more people onto the sidewalks as we do away with the manufacturing sector in America. So those are some of the areas that we have got to move forward on if we're serious about creating the jobs that this country desperately needs. The other issue that I urge people to follow very, very, very closely is this whole debate on deficit reduction. I fear, and we're active in this fight. I'm chairman of a committee called the Defending Social Security Caucus. And what I'm worried about is that despite the fact that the current deficit was caused by Bush's wars in Iran and Afghanistan, which they simply forgot to pay for, huge tax breaks for the wealthiest people in this country, which they forgot to offset, this terrible recession, which was caused by the greed and recklessness and illegal behavior on Wall Street, which has resulted in substantially less revenue coming into the federal government, that our Republican friends and some Democrats think the way to move forward to a deficit reduction is to cut Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, education, food stamps, you name it, any program which benefits working families. I hope that most listeners understand that in terms of Social Security has not really contributed one nickel to the deficit because it is funded by the payroll tax, not the general treasury. Social Security has a $2.7 trillion surplus. Social Security can pay out every benefit for the next 22 years. The struggle against Social Security has nothing to do with deficit reduction. What it has everything to do with is an ideological struggle that Republicans have been waging from years and years and years back. They don't like Social Security because Social Security is a government program that works. In a cost-effective way, we have managed to pay out every benefit owed to every eligible American for the last 75-plus years. That is a pretty good record.
Yeah.
And that's what they don't like, so they want to destroy Social Security. Medicare, you know, what Romney is talking about, what the Ryan budget is about, and everybody has got to know this, is ending Medicare as it is right now, converting it into a voucher plan. So if you are old, they're going to give you a check, maybe $7,000, maybe $8,000. And if you've got cancer and you've got a heart disease or you've got any serious illness, you tell me how long $7,000 or $8,000 worth of insurance is going to get you through a private insurance company. It'll get you a couple of days in the hospital, and then you are on your own. And then when you cut Medicaid, it means not only throwing large numbers of children off of the Children's Health Insurance Program and lower-income people, many people do not know. They have their parents, their mom, their dad is in a nursing home, and they don't know who's paying for it. Well, I'll tell you who's paying for it. In many cases, it's Medicaid. Hmm. Medicaid is certainly the largest payer of nursing home care in this country. So if you've got a parent who's in a nursing home and they cut Medicaid, guess who's going to pick up that bill? You are.
This is that must be why when my mom was toward the end of her life, my brothers basically they had to spend everything she had before she qualified right. for medical services, right. even though she was over 65.
Right. That's exactly right. Now,
wow.
Be that as it may, that is what happens. People get Medicaid for their parents in nursing homes, and nursing homes are a very expensive proposition. But my point is sometimes people say, well, you know, that's for somebody else. It's not for me. You know, we had a call on this show last month from a very nice lady in Texas, I believe, rural Texas, and she said, you know, government is interfering in Medicare. Well, guess what? Medicare is a government program. Millions of people don't know that.
Yeah.
So I think what this campaign, you know, getting, you know, into the campaign, if people understand what our right-wing Republican friends and what Governor Romney are talking about, it will be hard for me to see how they're going to win the election. But we've got to do a better job in exposing that.
Absolutely. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour here on the Tom Hartman program. Up next, your calls with Senator Sanders, our national town hall meeting. Check out Bernie's website, by the way, sanders.senate.gov. We'll be right back with your calls for the Senator.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And, of course, we've got a free iPhone and iPad app. We have the daily stack of everything we talk about every day. All of that over, all for free over at TomHartman.com.
Never before in all our history have these forces been so united against one candidate as they stand today. They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, taking back the mainstream media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls. And Corky in Rochester, New York, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, Senator, my hero.
Hi, Corky.
I'd love to see you get on that Senate floor and start beating this puppy. The American people haven't had a raise for 30 years. Come on, what don't they understand? There's no jobs because there's no demand.
Right.
Wealth doesn't create jobs. Tax breaks don't create jobs. Demand creates jobs. And that's the only thing that does.
Well, Corky, I agree with you. And the point that Corky is making, and I want everybody to understand, because it's a very, very important point, is that if working people, if the vast majority of the American people do not have money to spend, we're not going to create jobs. If they're not out buying appliances, if they're not out going to restaurants, if they're not out doing this and they're not out doing that, we are not going to create the jobs that we need. And the problem we have right now is we have more and more and more income and wealth inequality in this country. And I want to just give you a fact, Corky, that we don't talk about enough, media doesn't talk about enough, and that is what we're looking at right now is this is really quite unbelievable. The top 1% of Americans owns 40% of the wealth. The bottom 60% of Americans owns less than 2% of the wealth. The bottom 40% of Americans own just 0.3% of the wealth of this country.
It's astounding.
So the people on top have got it virtually all, and there is a limit. I think this is Corky's point, to how many yachts and planes and big homes they can buy. And if you want to stimulate the economy, if you want the middle class to be turned around, right, and grow rather than shrink, you're going to have to put money into the hands of working families. So that means better wages, decent-paying jobs, and full employment, not the austerity that we're seeing right now. So the concentration of wealth and income, in which so few have so much, while so many have so little, is not only morally obnoxious, but it is bad economics if we're serious about turning this economy around.
Larry, in Rochester, Minnesota, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, privilege to talk to Bernie and you. Hey, I was listening to Bernie talking about all these governors that are turning down Medicaid help in their states.
Mm-hmm.
I think this should be tried for premeditated murder.
Well, I'll tell you something, Larry. I think when, you know, the sad reality is that there are a whole lot of people in this country who, for whatever reason, really don't have a full sense of what's going on in this country. But when they find out that this big, bad, terrible health care reform bill, so-called Obamacare, is going to expand Medicaid to the tune of some 30 million people, that's a lot of people. And in fact, the federal government is going to pick up the cost of that. I believe it's 100%. I believe for the first 3 years.
That's right.
And then something like 90 or 95% in the following years. And people are sitting here saying, you mean to say the federal government is prepared to provide health insurance for more kids, for more working families, and you, governor, and it's not going to cost the state a nickel, and you, governor, are going to turn that down? Well, what Larry just said is right. There are people who are in desperate need of health care, who are not going to be able to get that health care. I have not the slightest doubt that some of those people will die or will become much sicker than they should because of that governor's decision. And I think, actually, the degree to which people understand that reality, you know, governors can't go on and say, well, you know, it's going to cost our state a fortune. Well, guess what? It's not. Federal government's picking up the cost for that expansion to the tune of 100%. And then it's going to go down. But 90% is nothing to sneeze at either. So if governors want to reject it, I would hope that the people of their states will say, excuse me, that is not acceptable.
James in Uniontown, Pennsylvania. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator. This is James in Uniontown, Pennsylvania.
Hi, James.
Hey, the question is, how are or how is the federal government going to pay for the Affordable Health Care Act, what you just talked about, to the states? You said you're going to pay 100% for the first 3 years,
mm-hmm.
and then 90% after that.
Well, one of the ways that we're going to be paying for it is by keeping people healthier. James, one of the things that we did in that bill, which I am very pleased to have worked on quite hard, is double the number of community health centers in this country, which means that people will get access to the most cost-effective healthcare, primary health care in this country. I think also, as part of this great controversy about what happens for people who today don't have any health insurance, there will be, you can call it a tax, you can call it a penalty, but it exists in Romney's bill in Massachusetts. And what I think the government appropriately said, it's not my approach, I believe very much in a single-payer system, which would move in a very different direction. But right now, if you are 30 years of age and you have money and you don't have health insurance and you get hit by a bus, well, guess what, James? You and other people around this country who do have health insurance are going to pick up the cost of health care for that person. That's kind of freeloading, and it's really much, in my view, not what conservatives should be defending when they talk about personal responsibility. Other people should not have to pick up somebody else's health care costs. And that will bring in some revenue as well.
Okay. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour, a national town hall meeting with Senator Sanders taking your calls. More right after this. Check out Bernie's website, by the way, sanders.senate.gov. And you can drop by ours at tomhartman.com. However you spell it, we'll get you there. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Oh, and also in our third hour today, Senator Sherrod Brown is going to drop by. That should be very interesting. He's got a lot to say about international trade and the election. Stick around. Talk media for the sane among us. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls in our national town hall meeting. Bernie, you're still with us?
I'm right here.
Okay. Let's pick up a call here from Paul in San Francisco, listening on tomhartman.com. Hey, Paul, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello. Yes, I'm calling to ask about the Trans-Pacific Partnership treaty that's being negotiated in secret. My understanding, the information that I get, is that what this will do is basically give extraordinary rights to multinational corporations that will kind of override issues of national sovereignty in things like food labeling, labor rights, and so on and so forth. I was wondering what's your opinion about this?
Paul, I share those concerns. You're talking to somebody who was in the House for 16 years and in the Senate for 5 years, and I don't believe I've ever voted for any of these trade agreements because I think for a variety of reasons they work primarily to benefit large corporations and not working families in this country or often in the other countries as well. As a matter of fact, if I'm not mistaken, I'm going to be meeting with representatives of our trade office just to go over this issue. I spoke to our trade representative a couple of weeks ago. My own concern here is above and beyond everything that Paul said, which I think is all right on and relevant, is the issue of prescription drugs. One of the problems we have is what these trade agreements often do is make it harder for developing countries to get drugs through generics, and they force them to buy the brand name, which means a whole lot of profit for the drug companies, but a lot of unnecessary death and suffering for the poor people in those countries who often can't afford the high-cost prescription drugs. So that's one of the issues that we are going to be looking at. In that regard, we have done some work on AIDS. And the point is right now, generically, you can buy the AIDS cocktail, the most widely used AIDS cocktail called Atripla. generically for something like $250. In this country, if you were to purchase that product, it would cost you over $20,000. So the profit margin is enormous between the brand name and the generic, and that's one of the concerns that I have in this TPP agreement.
Robert in Northeast Maryland, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, hi, Bernie. I was wondering, since that we're, I don't know what's going on with Slendra right now, but is there any way that we could open that up and start putting solar panels on the federal buildings that we're in?
Well, I think, you know, Robert, you're talking to the guy who introduced legislation called 10 million solar rooftops. My Republican friends and Fox TV like to point out all of the problems or the setbacks that we have seen in sustainable energy. And it turned out that Solyndra was selling a product that was not competitive. But the reality is that we're seeing an explosion in the use of solar panels in this country and around the world, creating a whole lot of new jobs. A lot of companies are doing quite well. So I believe absolutely that what we should be doing is investing very heavily in solar. Here in the state of Vermont, I work with the Vermont National Guard. They have the largest second largest solar installation in the state. They're saving about $250,000 a year on their electric bills. And we're seeing that kind of development all over America. The goal here is to make sure that these products are made in America to the degree that we can. But I think the more demand that we can create, the cheaper the cost will be. And those costs are already plummeting in the last few years. So I see a lot of potential in solar. And I would just conclude, many of my Republican friends, oh, they believe in everything. They believed in solar, and they believe in wind, and they believe in coal, and they believe in oil. Don't believe it. They have worked very, very hard to make it difficult for us to renew energy tax credits for a sustainable energy. And what you're really seeing to a significant degree is the fossil fuel industry fighting back furiously against sustainable energy.
Sharon in, is it Clupier, Iowa? Sharon?
Yes.
Hi. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, Senator. It's very nice to talk to you.
You too.
I have a question. In all the years that I worked, you know, at times when, you know, things got tight with the company and everything, our union and our workers were, you know, asked to take concessions, less wages, less benefits, and that type of thing. And with the government and the state of the government right at this time, my question is, why are they not asked to take some concessions on their retirement packages, on their insurance packages, on their income? It seems to me that, you know, the people that are out in this, you know, the communities and everything that don't make that kind of money are having to pay for everything the same way they are, but they're not taking a hit on any of their benefits or wages or income.
Sharon, if I understand you correctly, I think what you're, and let me just tell you this, there has been a significant attack on federal wages and benefits. There has been a wage freeze for the last couple of years for most federal employees, and there are demands that they contribute a whole lot more to their pensions. But this is what I think, Sharon. I think that the folks who push that, who go around the country saying, well, if you're in the private sector, you're paying a whole lot for your health insurance. If you're in the private sector, you don't have a pension plan. If you're in the private sector, your wages may not be as good as public employees, and therefore what you have got to do is demand cutbacks for public employees. What that is about, Sharon, in my mind, is kind of a race to the bottom where they divide working people between public employees and private employees. The real issue is not that we should be cutting back on the wages and benefits of public employees, but that we should be significantly figuring out a way to raise wages and benefits for private sector employees. What's going on now, as I mentioned earlier, the people on top are doing phenomenally well, And there's nothing more that they want to see. And you're seeing this in Republican states. They want a war going on between private sector employees and public employees. Well, it's not that our public employees are getting rich. The reality is that almost all of the new income being created in recent years hasn't gone to public employees. Let me tell you that. It has gone to the top 1%. And what we have got to figure out is why, when productivity is increasing in the private sector and in the public sector, real wages are going down for both groups, while the people on top are making out like bandits. So I am not a fan of this concept of race to the bottom, that the public, you know, the teachers or cops or firemen or state employees are just doing phenomenally well. We got to cut them. The answer is to understand why private sector people are leaving the middle class and entering the ranks of poverty, while the people on top are doing so well. So that's kind of my view on that, Sharon.
Marcus in Arcata, California. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. And just to respond to what you were just saying, I find the public employees to be overstaffed and fat in their number. And to back that, I'm a solo remodeler, contractor, and I've been self-employed for about 30 years. I'm in my 50s. I'm in excellent condition and excellent health, and I've been taking care of myself the entire time. And I take full responsibility for that as well, as I look forward to in the future. And I'm curious if the health care means then that I have to buy an insurance policy that I probably won't use till I'm 95, 96.
Marcus, I'm sorry. Did you say that you won't use till you're 95 or 96?
What was your question, Marcus?
I'll tell you something. You are a very, very lucky guy because you are absolutely sure that you're not going to get sick and have to go to the doctor and have a hospital and have a heart attack or get hit by a bus until you're 95 or 96. You are a very, very, very fortunate guy. But this is what's going to happen, Marcus. If you leave your office today and you get hit by a bus and you end up in the hospital and the bill is $50,000 or $100,000, you know who's going to pay that bill for you, Marcus? If you don't have insurance, your neighbors are. People who are making $20,000 or $30,000 a year or $40,000 a year are going to have to pay your hospital bill because you got hit by the bus or because you had a heart attack or because you were diagnosed with cancer. I hope very much that you are right, and I hope that you live to 95 or 96 and you have no medical expenses. Maybe that will be the case. But you know what, Marcus? It may not be the case. So I think when you talk about personal responsibility, it's not just keeping yourself healthy. That's great. It is to understand that if you have an accident, if you are diagnosed with a serious disease, it is, in a sense, unfair for people who have less money than you are to have to pick up the cost of your health care. Now, I myself, as I've said before, I believe in a single-payer system where people contribute into funding for health care based on their ability to pay. That's my preference. But I am not a great fan of people who have the money saying what you just said is, hey, you know, I don't want to pay. Other people will pay for me. So we have a disagreement, Marcus.
And we'll see how this all plays out with Obamacare and the Affordable Care Act and everything else. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Bernie's taking your calls in our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie. Check out his website at sanders.senate.gov. You can check out ours over at tomhartman.com. All kinds of great stuff there over at tomhartman.com. We also have a new free app, an iPhone and iPad app. Watch
the
show.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit tomhartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more of your calls for Senator Sanders right after this.
Yesterday was Thursday. Today it is Friday. We so excited.
Welcome back.
Tomorrow
Anything Goes
Saturday.
Friday comes up after Bernie's hour here. This is the Brunch with Bernie Hour, our national town hall meeting on the Tom Hartman Program. Mary in St. Paul, Minnesota. You're on the air with Bernie, Senator Sanders.
Hi, Bernie. Senator Sanders. I wanted to talk about two things, but one is that I just wanted to address the statement of a couple people that called earlier and said that people who are government workers have way too many people working in the departments and that kind of thing. We have been cut over and over again. I work for the health department at the city, and we get cut every year. We have to cut down it. Okay, this year you have to cut down by 10%, then next year another 10%. We are operating on a skeleton crew right now. And not only that, but they talk about wages and benefits. But when you compare that to the private sector, when you take the management and compare the management, our manager of the whole Department of Public Health makes about $140,000 a year. That's compared to $38,000 an hour that the CEO of United Health was making 5 years ago. I don't know how much he makes now. But you can't even, that's not even a comparison. So the management is making way more money in the private sector.
Right.
And even if we were making more money, you know, the people at the bottom of the government were making a little bit more money than the people in the private sector. Once you include management in there, it's crazy. But I also wanted to ask you, is there more to it, the costs for the Obamacare? You mentioned the community centers.
Yeah. Well, there's the goal, let's back it up and understand, Mary, that we have the most expensive and wasteful healthcare system in the entire world. Approximately 30% of every healthcare dollar goes to administration, goes to bureaucracy, goes to profiteering, and so forth. While Obamacare does not go anywhere near as far as I would like, it does create a more cost-effective system. The second point, and this really seems to be strange, but it's true, is when you provide health care to people, in many instances, that person will end up spending less because we're keeping them healthy. We put billions of dollars in that bill to disease prevention, to efforts to make sure that young kids are not into alcohol, they're not into smoking, they're not into drugs, which ends up resulting not only in human suffering, but in expensive health care. So I think what we have done in a variety of ways, let me repeat again, I believe in a single-payer system. I would go in a very different direction than where Obamacare went. But I think if you look at the effort we made into disease prevention, community health centers, the efforts that we made to make sure that people are not going to be denied insurance because of pre-existing conditions, the fact that young people, 26 or younger, can stay on their parents' plan, the fact that there will be a cap on the amount of money that people have to pay for insurance, no matter what their illness. All in all, this bill is a step forward, not to mention expanding Medicaid to 30 million more people.
Okay. Let's see here. Whoop, Matt in St. Louis, Missouri. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Senator Sanders, on the subject of the war on drugs, do you see value in using marijuana as medicine to treat sick Americans?
I think there is, not an expert on this, Matt, but I think there is some evidence to suggest that people who are experiencing severe pain get some relief by smoking marijuana. So do I support the idea of marijuana being used for legitimate medical purposes? I do.
Dan, in Palmdale, California, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes. I just wanted to maybe help clarify the issue on the high cost of medications. In part, the Honorable Sanders is perfectly correct. However, different countries have different FDAs. The FDA here in this country is very strict. So the Canadian, for example, FDA may be a little less strict or have different policies. So drugs
Go ahead, Bernie.
I didn't mean to interrupt, Dan, but it has nothing to do with the FDA. The reason that prescription drugs are much less expensive in other countries is when you have a national health care system, whatever it may be, the English system is different than the Canadian system, the government negotiates prices with the drug companies. In America today, Dan, you walk into a drugstore, the price of your medicine could have doubled, and no one says anything. The company could double it, can triple it, and that sometimes happens. So companies can charge as much as they want, and they do. But if you are in any country that has a national health care system, then the system itself negotiates with the drug companies and negotiates prices that are far less expensive than here in the United States of America. And I think I told this story before, how a number of years ago when I was in the House, I took over a busload of working class women who were dealing with breast cancer here in the state of Vermont. We went to Montreal, Canada, and they bought the drug that they needed, which was a drug called tamoxifen, for one-tenth of the price that they were buying it here in the United States, one-tenth of the price. That was then. I think it's changed somewhat since. But all over the world, the same drugs that people are taking, brand-name drugs that people are taking in the United States today, sell for a fraction of that price in Europe. And that's because they negotiate prices with the drug companies. Here, drug companies can charge you any price they want.
Bernie, we have a little less than a half a minute to wrap up this hour. Thoughts on the week and the future?
Well, I think obviously the presidential election and elections all over the country are becoming hot and heavy. And I hope people do not, you know, very often the media gets into gossip and this said, this person said this or that. Stay on the issues. Remember where we were, and again, I've been critical of Obama on this show in many places and in many ways, but remember where we were when Bush left office, 700,000 jobs being lost a month, and we're on the verge of an international financial collapse. I think it's important to pay attention to the real issues, that is the need to create jobs, the need to defend Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, the need to reverse global warming. Let's stay focused on the real issues and demand that politicians talk to those issues.
Thank you. Bernie, thanks again so much for being with us this week.
My pleasure. Take care.
We'll be back. And don't forget to check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. Coming up next, Anything Goes Friday. And in our third hour, Sherrod Brown will be with us.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
It's Friday. Welcome back. Anything Goes Friday. In the next hour, Sherrod Brown is going to be with us in this hour. It's all you and your calls. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number, Rodney in Chicago. Hey, Rodney, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how you doing? Hey, I had a question for Bernie, but perhaps you could pose it to Sherrod Brown as well. Now, let me preface the question with I attended the National Nurses United protest here not too long ago during the NATO summit, and what they're advocating is the so-called Robin Hood tax, and I wanted to know if Bernie and Senator Brown supported that.
I can't speak for Sherrod Brown, but I can tell you for a fact that Bernie Sanders supports the STET tax, the securities transaction excise tax that we had in this country from the 1930s, from 1935, I think it was, when the SEC was created. It might have been 34, right up until the mid-1960s when it was generating so much extra money that the Republicans said, we don't need all this money, and they did away with it. And it was a small, like one-tenth of 1% tax on every stock transaction. And what that would do if it was brought back is, you know, all these banks, the six big banks have had, with the exception of J.P. Morgan's losses in London, they have had month after month after month, I forget how many, something like 16, 18 months, some incredible streak of every single month they win in the stock market. How do they do that? They do that because they're not actually trading in the stock market. What they're doing is they're buying a stock, and then a hundredth of a second or a thousandth of a second later, they're selling it just as it moves a little bit. And it's all being done by computers, no humans involved, no logic involved, no thoughtfulness involved. It is driving up the stock market. It probably accounts for 30 or 40% of the cost of the, or the so-called value of the stock market. It's a phony baloney value. And if we were to have this debt tax, the banks would not be able to siphon off this money off the top. Our stock market would reflect real value. We've got a bubble right there, and we've got a bubble in student housing that are both yet to burst, and it's going to be very painful when they do. And
I have another quick topic.
Okay, go for it.
Now, you was talking in the last of the news segment, you know, Fox and the Sharia law thing that Obama's supposedly pushing. Well, that might not be such a bad thing. It'd probably be more fair and equitable than the criminal justice system that we have currently.
What, if Obama were to outlaw Fox News?
Well, no, I mean, they're saying that they're gonna, he's pushing Sharia law.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that, yeah, the joke, yeah.
Well,
yeah,
we, Fox News wouldn't be a bad thing either.
Okay, thanks, Rodney. I'm not a fan of Sharia law personally, but, you know, to each their own. Is it Nadia or Nadia in South Elgin, Illinois?
It's Nadia.
Nadia,
hi,
welcome.
Tom.
Hey.
Thank you. I just wanted to call and say that you're my hero and my mentor. I got active. I am a precinct committeeman as well
wonderful.
As a candidate for Kane County Board District 14. And I'm looking for support.
Uh-huh.
But first, I wanted to mention an event that I'm putting together. It's called Women in Government Forum.
Mm-hmm.
And it's happening on July 12th at the Arcata Theater in St. Charles, Illinois.
Okay.
It is to bring awareness of the women attack on women and women's issues and women in government at the local level.
Great. Is there a website for that, Nadia?
It's on Facebook.
Okay.
It's Women in Government Forum.
Okay, Women in Government Forum.
My website is Nadia at KaneCountyBoard.com. Anyone can donate and help me get elected.
Great.
I'm the old-fashioned Democrat.
Okay. Nadia, I wish you the very best, and thank you very much for the call. Great to hear from you. Dave in Murphy's, California, says you disagree with me, Dave, about what?
Well, Tom, I respectfully disagree, and it's probably for the first time. It's about the personal responsibility theory in healthcare. First, it is insurance, which is betting on disaster or covering our liabilities.
And hoping that we lose.
And yeah, we're betting against ourselves.
Yeah.
This is something we buy when there might be a liability to others. But say our diet is excellent, tests from our doctor says we're in excellent health, then our money might be better invested elsewhere. So if you say...
Well, tell that to the 50,000 Americans every year who die because they're hit by drunk drivers.
Well, you have auto insurance, and you have a medical part in your auto insurance.
Not so much.
Well, what I think the focus is wrong, I think that the American people and the market demand a single-payer system, which is the necessary piece of the puzzle to provide insurance discounts for healthy Americans. If Medicare is 97% efficient for patient care, I believe the real focus on personal responsibility should be on the 1%. Notably corporate profits.
Mm-hmm.
Let there be some real competition and personal responsibility, beginning with less CEO compensation.
Yeah, well, if you want less CEO compensation, I'm all in favor of raising corporate income tax rates back up to the levels that they were at during the time of greatest prosperity in America, which was the 50s, 60s, 70s, and early 80s, when corporations were paying about 35% of the total income of the federal government. Now it's around 7 or 8%. I'm all in favor of doing that because it obviously worked for us. But in addition to that, if you want to cut CEO salaries, the really simple way to do that is twofold. Undo the law that was passed during the Reagan era that allowed corporations to pay executives with stock options. That never should have been done because it puts executives in a position where they're looking out for the interests of stockholders rather than for the interest of the company itself. And if they're running the company, they should be looking out for the interests of the company itself, its customers and employees, not the stockholders. And secondly, bring back, you know, go back. There was somebody tweeting here earlier about, you know, the Reagan recovery in 84 was just great. Why can't we have one like that? Well, in 1984, the top marginal tax rate was 50% on very wealthy people. And so instead of putting their money like Mitt Romney has in Swiss bank accounts, they put their money back in their companies. I mean, they keep their money in their companies rather than taking it out. So I say roll back the Reagan tax cuts. It's 2 years later, Reagan dropped that top tax rate from 50% down to 28%. It was 74% when he first came into office. Undo the Reagan tax cuts, and you will see CEO salaries go back to normal. It's very, very simple and very straightforward. By the way, I have a question. Maybe somebody has an answer for this. I haven't been able to figure it out. TPM is doing great reporting on this, by the way. Josh Marshall over there. We've talked on this program a number of times about the difference between pensions and 401ks and savings accounts and all that. And 401ks are basically you can put money in an investment in a 401k. Yeah, it has to be registered. You have to do this whole song and dance, which is why I don't have one. And and you can't take it out without huge penalties until you're, I think, 65 or whatever. I don't know all the details and rules on it. But one of the rules that I do know on 401ks is that you can't put more than $6,000 a year into them. Right? That's like not in dispute. Mitt Romney has $100 million in his 401k. Now, if you can only put in $6,000 a year, how do you get even $1 million into a 401k if you're only in your 60s? I mean, Mitt Romney is in his mid-60s. How is that possible? And how do you get $100 million into a 401k if the limit for everybody else, I mean, is there a different 401k limit for people who are quarter billionaires? Most of the speculation that I've seen over at TPM that Josh Marshall has been making is that this is how Romney is using his tax havens to basically scam us so that you and I are having to pay his income taxes, and he's able to pay absolutely no income tax on that money that he puts into these 401ks, and he's doing it through a complex series of tax doodads where the 401k borrows money and then buys stock like in Bain and then puts it into the 401k and then moves it offshore to some country where there's no tax and then jacks up the value. Who knows? But how did he get $100 million in a 401k?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And do you really want somebody that sneaky as president? At least sneaky about their money? I don't know. I don't think so. Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program, fair and only slightly unbalanced. Gary in Chicago. Hey, Gary, what's up?
My German-born doctor says to graduate from their educational system, they either have to take ethics or some positively based religion. I think if we were to do that here, we the people would be the theme rather than greed is good being the theme.
Yeah, I agree. I had a little bit of a problem with it when we lived in Germany. Our oldest was in gymnasium in high school, and all three of our kids actually were in the public school system, and they had to declare their religion so they could decide which class they could put them in for religious studies. And basically the two religions that you could declare were Protestant or Catholic. But on the other hand, looking at the way that the religious studies class was put together, it was more of an anthropological perspective than an evangelical perspective. They were not preaching religion in the school. They were simply teaching the history of those particular religions. And they really kind of covered both. I feel very ambivalent about it, but I do think that we should be teaching ethics in the United States. We should be teaching, we should be teaching critical thinking. I mean, you know, isn't it amazing that Texas Republican Party said that they want to take critical thinking out of our schools, right? And I think that we should be teaching comparative religions in an anthropological context. Here's how different people have believed over time.
Yeah, minds are formed when they're young. And speaking of young minds are going to experiment with drugs. And so it's better that they use marijuana than they spray something in a plastic bag and sniff it where their synapses in their brain would separate.
Yeah, or then they drink alcohol, which will dissolve their brains.
Well, alcohol, but that spraying that stuff in the plastic bag and sniffing it, young people do that, and I've seen that in my life. And so marijuana would be better off than that.
Yeah, I'm with you. It's both a therapeutic and a recreational drug. Benny in Whitney Point, New York. Hey, Benny, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I spent last weekend in D.C., and I was walking around the mall with my 7 and 10-year-old boys and explaining to them the different memorials, and it hit me all at once that we build memorials to people and leaders who help people. And I wonder if the politicians in D.C. ever leave their air-conditioned office to go out and see that and understand that.
You know, you're absolutely right. It's like on Mount Rushmore, you've got Teddy Roosevelt, who busted up the big trusts. You got Franklin Roosevelt. Well, there's an FDR memorial here. Franklin Roosevelt brought us the New Deal. Abraham Lincoln, the Lincoln Memorial, he brought our nation together and tried to heal and bind our wounds. The Washington Memorial, of course, he created a country. And I don't see memorials to, like, Calvin Coolidge or Herbert Hoover or, you know, the great Republican icons, Ulysses S. Grant even, you know, arguably one of the most corrupt administrations in, certainly in the 19th
exactly.
century.
Exactly. And, I mean, we were at the Martin Luther King Memorial, which is incredible, mm-hmm. and I was like, I don't understand it. Why yeah. don't more people want to be like these people?
Yeah. It's maybe I can partially answer that question. I don't know if you're old enough to remember Scholastic magazine in school.
No.
Okay. Well, when I was a little kid in the 50s and 60s, and we had this magazine called Scholastic or Junior Scholastic or something like that. And they used to every year do this study and this survey where they would ask kids, school children across America, who are your heroes? And what they found was up until, if I'm remembering this story right, it was in Parade Magazine, did a big deal about it back in the late 80s, as I recall, or the early 90s, as part of the, oh, isn't Ronald Reagan amazing, you know, thing that was going on at the time. Up until the Reagan administration, throughout the history of that magazine, again, assuming my recollection is correct, and if not, I'm sure somebody in the chat room will correct me, but up until that point, kids always named public figures who had done good. In other words, they wanted to grow up to be like Gandhi, or they wanted to grow up to be like George Washington, or they wanted to grow up to be like Dwight Eisenhower, or they wanted to grow up to be like John Kennedy, you know, those kinds of things. And then came the Reagan presidency, and suddenly they wanted to grow up to be like Michael Milken, or they wanted to grow up to be like Bill Gates, or they wanted to grow up to be like Warren Buffett. They wanted to grow up to be billionaires. And America shifted in the 80s. I mean, there was a fundamental shift in the zeitgeist, the spirit of the time is literally what zeitgeist means in German. And Geist is ghost and Zeit is time. The ghost of the time, the spirit of the time. There was this shift from we're all in this together. Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. You know, a necessitous man is not a free man. All those, you know, quotes from FDR and Jack Kennedy and whatnot. We shifted from that to greed is good, you're on your own, and the American dream is no longer to get a decent job and put your kids through school and end up owning your own home and having a pension when you retire. The American dream is now to be one of that 1% who have struck it rich. And
exactly.
It's a tragedy. It's absolutely a tragedy. Benny, thank you for the call. Very well said. Laura in Chicago, listening to WCPT. Hey, Laura, we got a minute to the break. It's all yours. What's up?
Okay, yeah, all this talk about healthcare, I really want to encourage everyone, we must take care of our own health. I just don't know how this is all going to turn out. And we can do so much to improve our health. So I'm calling about the GMO issue. You know, California has got the ballot initiative to label GMOs. And
yeah.
There was a new report out today, Tom, I don't know if you read it, but it's from the Earth Open Source. About the dangers of genetically modified foods, the health dangers.
I've read many of them.
Yeah, they're coming out regularly now. This stuff is very dangerous. Liver disease, gastrointestinal disease, allergic reactions, kidney disease, infertility. It just one thing after another. So I want to encourage everybody in California, please vote for the label of the GMO labeling initiative in November.
Yep.
And if you're in Oregon, they are starting a process to get it on the ballot in November in Oregon.
That's great. And this isn't even to ban them. This is simply to say, hey, guess what's in your food? And in most of Europe, they're just simply banned. Connie, thank you very much for the call, and thanks for pointing that out. I'm sorry, that wasn't Connie. Connie is up next. We'll be back. It's 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And you can drop into our free live chat room. Go over to TomHartman.com and click Community. You'll discover amazing stuff. Welcome back. Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program, 34 minutes past the hour. And Bill in Colville, Washington. Hey, Bill, what's on your mind? Bill? Oop, hang on just a minute. It helps if I push the right button. Bill, now you're on the air.
Border Patrol in northern Stevens County.
Mm-hmm. It's I've lived in this area for over 30 years, and I can't believe it's just like truckload after truckload of these guys with four-wheelers and snowmobiles and what have you, horses, everything, guarding us from those dangerous Canadians.
Wait a minute, you're seeing a militarization, a buildup of border guard presence on the northern border?
Yes.
Wow.
And
I wonder what they're looking for.
They're building a facility in Colville, Washington, with a 97-bed facility, detention center.
Uh-huh.
Now, you know, I mean, the Canadians are our partners.
Sort of.
Are they not?
Depends on what you're talking about. But
well yeah. But I just want to bring attention to it.
Okay.
Why?
Well, you just did. I don't know why. I think the whole thing, this whole, you know, we got to protect our borders is crazy. Yeah, the vast majority of people in the United States did not come, who are here illegally, did not come across the Sonoran Desert, you know, by coyote and water jug in hand and all that kind of stuff. That's a small minority. The vast majority of them came as tourists, and when their visa war, you know, expired, they stayed. And it's that's the vast majority of Mexicans. The vast majority of Irish illegal immigrants, of British illegal immigrants, of French. I mean, we got illegal immigrants from all over the world. They just, you know, they overstayed their visa. You're never going to stop that. The only way that you can put a dent in that is by putting employers in jail when they hire people who are not citizens. It's really simple. And it's what every other country in the world pretty much does and what Reagan stopped us from doing in 1986. And guess what? Suddenly we had employers who were wiping out industries. When I was a little kid, you could be a carpenter and raise a family. A good union carpenter job? One of my brothers was a union electrician. I mean, you know, construction trades. You could make good money. You could raise your family. You could put your kids through college. Because back then, before 86, you hired somebody, they had to be an American. And but the flip side of this is this whole, you know, okay, then let's beat up on the immigrants. There is, in my mind, absolutely nothing wrong with anybody saying, I'm going to do whatever it takes to make a better life for me and my kids and my grandchildren. I mean, you know, God bless them, if they're willing to deal with the consequences of it. But to say that we're going to say to the fat cats in this society, to the employers in this society, the corporations in this society, oh, yeah, you can hire people who are here illegally, and you can even threaten them with exposure if they don't work for $3 an hour or if they complain that you didn't pay them. Which goes on all the time. Or if they're, you know, if they're women, if you sexually exploit them, which goes on all the time. And there'll be no consequence to you, Mr. Employer, because after all, this is the Reagan Republican policy. We don't have an illegal immigrant problem in this country. We have an illegal employer problem. When are going to people wake up to this? Rich in Denver. Hey, Rich, what's up?
Hey, greetings, Tom. I just want to say I love your show. It's awesome. I'm happy to hear Louise is doing good. I saw a bumper sticker the other day that said dogs against Romney.
That's great.
But along the lines of, yeah, and the illegal, you know, you're saying, you know, British Americans. I'm half Dutch, half English, you know. We all came here. We're all illegal.
Yeah.
I don't know what people are saying. You know, if anybody's illegal, they landed on the Native Americans, you know. And
yep.
We know what the white did to them, slaughtered them.
Yep.
So I don't know what people are saying, you know. I had a guy, I drive a taxi out here in Denver. I had a guy one time, he said, I'm 25% Navajo. And I said, oh, well, then you should really be pissed off at what the white man did to you, did to your ancestors, you know.
Yeah.
But to my question on Reagan, I was going to ask you, Tom, because you talk about the Reagan-Bush tax cuts. Are the Bush tax cuts just a continuation of the Reagan tax cuts? I mean, the Reagan tax cuts obviously
Reagan cut the top tax rate. It was at 74% when he came into office. In 84, he dropped it down to 50%. In 86, he dropped it down to 28%. And then he raised it back up to about 30 or 31% before he left office because it was just, you know, doing bad things. And then George Herbert Walker Bush raised it up to 33%, as I recall. Then Bill Clinton took it up to 39%, as I recall, or 37%, something like that. I don't have the numbers in front of me. I'm doing this from memory. But and then George W. Bush came along and dropped it back down to 33 or 35%, where it is right now. And so, yeah, not only was the Bush tax cuts basically the early and unsuccessful Reagan tax cuts, the ones that led to the SNL crash and to, you know, some serious problems, the biggest stock market fall in history in 86. Not only was it that, but I guess that's it. That's what it was. Yeah. And,
well,
and it,
so
go ahead.
It's a continuation basically then of
sure.
Of,
it's Reaganomics. It's okay. A continuation of that crazy theory that Art Laffer had. That, you know, where he drew this graph on a napkin for Ronnie and for Steve Moore, I guess, that said, you know, hey, if at 0% taxation, the government gets no income, and at 100% taxation, the government gets no income because nobody would work. Now, actually, there are a lot of us who would work even if it was 100% taxation. I love my job, and I would be here even if I wasn't paid to do it. But still, that was his theory. At 100% taxation, there's going to be nobody working. And so there's got to be this place in the middle where you optimize income to the government. And his theory was that place in the middle would probably be around 25% taxation. And actually, all he had to do was look at history. We had, you know, when we had a top tax rate of 91% over $300,000 to $1 million a year, you know, under that, the tax rate was much lower. But over that, it went up. That was the time, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s, and the early 80s, when we had the strongest economy literally in the history of the United States and arguably in the history of the world. So, you know, the debate had already been joined and won by the time Art Laffer came up with his laughable theory. Rich, thanks a lot for the call and for pointing it out. Connie in Midland, Michigan. I called somebody else Connie earlier. My apologies. What's up?
Yeah. About a week and a half ago, you talked about the Michigan legislators who silenced the women representatives.
Yes.
Who were standing up for women.
Yeah, Lisa and, Brown wasn't her name, the legislator who used the word vagina on the floor and got slapped down. Yeah.
Lisa Brown and Barb Byram.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of your listeners may not know that there is a progressive woman running against the Republican majority leader.
Oh!
And her name is Joan Brausch, and her website is www.brausch4house.
How do you spell that?
brausch4house.com.
Okay.
And she also has a Facebook page that's Brausch4house and a Twitter account.
Okay.
So people can check them all out.
Great. And tell me one more time how to spell her name.
B-R-A-U-S-C-H.
Great. Okay.
And one other thing, on the 18th, they're going to have a gathering for women take over the House in Lansing.
Mm-hmm.
And they're encouraging people not only to come to the assembly, but also to make appointments to meet with their legislators and talk to them about women's issues like jobs and health care and all of the other things. So come on out to the Capitol.
Okay. Connie, thank you very much for the call and for the shout out to everybody about this candidate and what's going on there. I hope it works really, really well. And give my very best to everybody in my old hometown of Lansing. And I've been to Midland. Say hi to Midland for me, too. Thank you. Robert in Meridian, Texas. Hey, Robert, what's up?
Tom, I just want to talk about this Obamacare, how the Republicans, the cons, don't want us to have it. So if we don't want this taken out of our check, we get our Social Security taken out of our check and our Medicare, our Medicaid. So, you know, and what do they have to offer besides no, no, and hell no? And I can't hear your response after this, so could you please hold me?
Yeah, Robert, that is the bottom line. I mean, that's the problem, is that the Republicans are saying no, no, and hell no. I mean, that's it. And they're not offering an alternative. They say they will. I mean, Romney, when he gave his speech here in D.C., was in front of a little placard that said repeal, replace. And then you ask him, okay, what are you going to replace it with? Don't know. And Chris Wallace tries to pin him down on Fox News. Well, and it wasn't him, it was Mitch McConnell, but same thing, you know, a surrogate for Romney. And he says, so how are you going to guarantee universal coverage? And McConnell says, that's not the issue. That's not the issue. So, you know, totally with you, Robert. It is a mess. Trying to undo this, trying to take apart Obamacare, is going to hurt a lot of people. We need to keep this thing in place, strengthen it, and do and encourage every state in the union to do what Vermont is doing, so that when 2014 or 2016 comes along and states can go their own way, they can start their own single-payer programs. It's the logical evolution.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And you can check out our brand new, well, not brand new, but newly reinvented for the Retina display on the iPad, our free iPad and iPhone app at TomHartman.com.
Ain't that good news? Man, ain't that news?
Speaking the truth to multinational corporations, who'd really rather didn't know all about. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And just a reminder, in the next hour, Sherrod Brown is going to be with us. And it's also Anything Goes Friday. We're taking your calls, but first, let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service. Our report brought to you by the German Embassy, which wants you to know that Germany supports the European strategy to strengthen the euro through fiscal stability, solidarity, and growth. You can learn more online at germany.info. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So what's up today?
Well, we had a jobs report out this morning, and there were 80,000 jobs created. The unemployment rate stayed at 8.2%, as I'm sure you know.
Yeah.
Reaction from the candidates. President Obama said that the numbers are a step in the right direction, but we can't be satisfied because our goal was never to just keep on working to get back to where we were in 2007. Mitt Romney said that they're a kick in the gut, and that the president's policies have clearly not been successful in reigniting the economy, in putting people back to work, and in opening factories across this country.
Do you think it's possible that Mitt Romney, what he really meant was that all these Republican efforts to filibuster, install any kind of legislation that would put people back to work, both nationally and statewide, and in the states across the United States, has not succeeded in taking us back to the Bush standard of losing 700,000 jobs a month? And therefore, since this was a positive number, that Romney feels like he's been kicked in the gut?
No.
No. Okay. All right. Well, I could try.
You could try. I don't think that's what he meant.
Hey, is anybody, I'm curious, you do a lot of radio shows. Is anybody, you know, the most you can contribute to a 401k is $6,000 a year?
Yes.
I don't know if you have one. I don't have one, but I understand that this is how it works. Is anybody asking the question, why does Mitt Romney or how does Mitt Romney have $100 million in his 401k?
Well, I have.
You've asked that question?
I have asked that question.
Of the Romney campaign?
No, I've asked that question of talk show hosts.
Oh, and right-wing talk show hosts. What do they say?
Nobody has an answer for that.
Oh.
I've heard a certain amount of, blabber.
Uh-huh.
But no answers. I have seen one interesting article, which you may have seen, which I will forward it to you, which got a bit in the weeds for me, but explained a very murky way that it could be done.
This is with the tax on borrowed money, that you don't have to pay a tax if you do it in the Cayman Islands. The Josh Marshall laid this out over at TPM. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, the Josh Marshall story, which
I've
found
read that.
very, very confusing, and it just sounded off.
Well, but the thing is, Josh Marshall keeps asking the Romney campaign, is this the tax dodge that you guys are using? And they keep refusing to answer. So,
of course. Well, they may not know because Romney may not be telling them.
Yeah, he does file multi-hundred page tax returns. So over 50 pages, 52 pages of his 2010 tax return was just devoted to his offshore investments.
Right. And they may not know the answer. He may not be telling them. Or if they do know the answer, they may choose not to tell him. I mean, there could be any number of reasons here, or they may not understand the answer.
Yeah. Okay. Fascinating.
It's so, very, very interesting.
It is. I'm scratching my head, and I'm wondering why the average American, who probably, you know, a lot of Americans have 401ks and know that they can only put $6,000 a year into it, has to be wondering, how did Mitt Romney get $100 million in a 401k? In other words, a totally tax sheltered investment that. How old is he now? What, 64, 65?
He's 64. Well, and he was only at Bain for 15 years.
Okay, so in 15 years he made all this money. He's got $100 million in a 401k, all of which will be available to him. It's all tax-free, all of which will be available to him starting next year. How do you do that?
Well, I don't know, and I think the American people, this is something that the American people would latch onto, would understand if it was being asked at the top of the network ABC News, but it's not.
Right.
Although I would say that ABC's done some quite good stories on this.
Yeah.
But it's not being asked in those terms. How can you have $100 million in an IRA if you can only contribute so much a year and you're only at a place 15 years? Everybody can do the math.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So what else is going on in the world?
Well, of course, there were a number of interesting conversations about the jobs numbers and a lot of attacks from both sides of the aisle on that.
Predictably.
Went pretty crazy. I would say it went viral, but it's the wrong use of the term. Meantime, in France today, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton slammed Russia and China at a meeting of the Friends of Syria, about 107 countries from the West and Arab states. She slammed them for blockading, as she called it, international efforts to bring an end to the Syrian crisis. This on the same day that confirmation has reached them that a very powerful Syrian military officer has defected from the government of Assad. She said, the Syrian people will remember the choices you make in the coming days, and so will the world. It is time to abandon the dictator, embrace your countrymen and women, and get on the right side of history.
Do you think that the Russians and Chinese are doing this because they've historically been strategic allies with Assad, with Syria? Or that they're doing it for the reasons that they've been putting out publicly, which is that, you know, if we get involved in another shooting war, it's going to get a lot worse than better. I mean, do you really want another Iraq?
I think Russia is doing it for complex reasons of its own. I mean, I think Putin is very in a complex and inscrutable man. I think he's doing it for his own power reasons. He's supplying arms to Assad. It is his last. It's his last bastion of power. It's his last outpost in the Middle East. He has nowhere left.
Yeah.
If he loses Syria.
I didn't know that. In fact, it seems that there are a lot more. Well, in any case, I this is not the geopolitical center of the universe right here. So what else is going on in the world?
President Obama today slammed Mitt Romney for lack of principles on the individual mandate and whether it's a tax. And also the New York Times did a nice piece on how often, in defending his health care plan, Mitt Romney has called the mandate a tax.
So wait a minute. Romney is attacking Obama for RomneyCare?
Obama attacked Romney over RomneyCare. What he said was, the fact that a whole bunch of Republicans suddenly said this is a tax, for 6 years he said it wasn't, and now he's suddenly reversed himself. So the question becomes, are you doing that because of politics?
I see. Okay. Yeah. Do you think? It could be. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
This Talk Radio News Service report brought to you by the German Embassy. You can learn more online at germany.info. Up next, Sherrod Brown will be with us. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Anything Goes Friday. We'll be getting back to your calls in just a moment. But first, Senator Sherrod Brown is on the line. Brown.senate.gov is his website. You can tweet him at Sen, S-E-N, Sherrod Brown, S-H-E-R-R-O-D, Brown, capital S, capital S, capital B. And Senator Brown, welcome back to the program.
Good to be back. Thanks, Tom. I appreciate it.
Thank you. You are probably the most outspoken, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think so, the most outspoken guy in the United States Senate on issues of the insanity of our international trade policies. I have this article here, Brown applauds action by U.S. trade representative to defend American auto jobs. Looking back on the election, where Ross Perot took 20% of the vote, basically opposing NAFTA and CAFTA and SHAFTA, it seems to me like any political party that would just say enough already is going to start winning elections like crazy. What's it going to take?
Yeah, I think that's probably right. I think Democrats have had a Republican. When I think about white working class voters, and particularly if they're non-union, Democrats have over time performed worse and worse among white working class non-union voters. And it's not like Republicans offer them anything except playing to fears and on social issues and other in taxes and some things like that. Democrats have not spoken to white working class voters the way that we should, especially on trade issues. And I think when you go, it really did start back with the North American Free Trade Agreement. Perot won a whole lot of voters that he shouldn't have won, that Democrats should be winning with a stronger, more populist trade message. And it's almost as if, you know, when you look around the world, that most countries conduct trade policy according to the national interest, and we seem to conduct it according to some 20-year-old out-of-date college textbook.
Yeah.
We do our trade policy, and it clearly doesn't work for it. Doesn't work politically, but substantively, it doesn't work at all as a country.
Well, and last night Rachel Maddow was pointing out on her program that, and I don't know how I missed this story, but it's a big deal. That in China, if you want to buy a Jeep Grand Cherokee, it's like $180,000 because of import tariffs.
Yeah.
And it's like, when did we get so dumb? And how are we going to do something about it? I mean, you've been pounding this drum for years.
And we got this dumb in large part because the company, there are a lot of American companies that benefit from this kind of a trade policy. I mean, first of all, they're the ones that lobbied for it. These companies, put it this way, it's the first time, I believe, in world history where the business plan for a lot of companies in one country is you shut down production in Steubenville or Cleveland or Toledo, Ohio, you move that production, that product to Shanghai or Wuhan or Xi'an, you produce it and you sell it back into the home country, back into the United States. And there are a lot of people in this country that benefit from that sort of that business construct, that business plan. They write the rules so that you need to do that. And then they argue, well, the only way we can compete is if we offshore our production and sell it back.
Right.
And we've let that happen. It's a fundamental betrayal of a lot of corporate interests, by a lot of corporate interests, the American middle class and American working class. And we all know that manufacturing is the key to the middle class for a whole lot of Americans. And that to mix metaphors, that rug's been pulled out from under them in far too many families' cases.
Yeah, absolutely. And it always astounds me when I get these conservatives who call into this program and go, oh, yeah, but, you know, and I'm going off on Mitt Romney, for example, being a vulture capitalist and or a pirate equity guy. And they say, oh, yeah, but, you know, he's got a success story there in Staples. And I'm like, oh, really? So that's how America should be. I walk into a Staples and I can't find anything that's not made in China or some other third world country. And I mean, China is almost not a third world country anymore. It's the second largest economy in the world. But I can't find anything made in America in a Staples. And most of the people working there are making something close to minimum wage. Is that really the model of America that these Republicans are so proud that Mitt Romney created that we should have?
And that's the company he almost always uses as his success story. That does tell you a lot. When you talk to people about a generation ago about opportunity, about how do you send your kids to college? How do you have a middle class? How do you get a chance to be even close to the middle class? And it always evolved around making things. And, we know how to make big things in this country. Our workers know how to make things. Yet we're taking away that opportunity, and we're seeing jobs, people losing jobs that they were making $16 and $18 and $20 an hour, and now making nine or $10 or $11 an hour, like you say. Instead of making things that we buy here, they're working at Staples for half the wage.
Yeah.
And it's not just what it does to those families, it's what it does to a whole community. When a company gets a tax break and shuts down in the United States and move overseas, look what it does to the number of to the teachers and the firefighters and the police officers and the city services in those communities, not just the families of those people that held the jobs.
Right. Now you've been fighting this battle for You've been in the Senate longer than 6 years, haven't you?
Well, no, I was in the Senate for six. I was in the House for 14.
Okay. Yeah.
My first term in the House, I worked with Congressman then Ben, Congressman David Bonier, and others, and against NAFTA. I mean, it was really the first big trade fight in Congress. And
wow, you stood up to Bill Clinton on that.
And yeah, Bill. I mean, I was opposed to the president of my own party, as I was opposed to President Bush on CAFTA and some of the things he did later.
Right.
But the issue, and I mean, it's clear where the public sits on these issues, and
yep.
That's why. So it's not just the substance is wrong for Democrats who support it. The politics is terrible for Democrats who support it. And I won in 2006. Much of my campaign was about how do you stand up for the middle class? And when you say the middle class, as President Obama said yesterday in Parma, Ohio, you really mean, as his words, poor folk who are playing by the rules and want a chance to be in the middle class.
Right.
And I ran an election based on that, based on making things, based on an economic nationalism that really would work for our country.
And he's starting to speak like that. God bless him for it. But you've been toiling in this vineyard for your entire political career.
Yeah.
What are the possibilities here in the 2 minutes or so we have left? What are the possibilities of some really deep and profound change in these trade policies happening?
I don't know. I mean, it's so interesting to hear Mitt Romney talk about currency as if he's been on the right side for 20 years instead of how you describe him in your shows about his private equity work.
Yeah, pirate equity, yes.
Pirate equity. I think that the public's there. The question is, do elected officials see it? I think President Obama's understanding as he takes this bus trip through Ohio this week, starting in Toledo yesterday and ending in Youngstown, then going to Pittsburgh. I think he's more and more starting to hear it and understand it. There's a lot of pressure on the White House always to back off of any kind of economic nationalist message. All the newspapers, including the quote-unquote more liberal papers like the New York Times, say you're engaging in class warfare, you're engaging in economic nationalism, or protectionism, as if protecting our interests is a terrible thing.
Protectionism is a good word to me.
Neighborhoods and yeah, and they and I just I think when they accuse us of that, we just keep going forward because it's clear it works for our national interests as a country. It works for working class families, and it's good politics for us too.
Yeah, it absolutely is, and we need to get the message out to more people better that there are people like you, Senator Sherrod Brown, who are standing up for American workers, for making products in America, who get it. You know, all the way back to 1776 when Adam Smith, Wealth of Nations, defined the wealth of nations as the ability to take a tree branch and add up a little human labor and convert it into an axe handle that has wealth. In other words, manufacturing. You are so spot on that.
Well said.
Sherrod Brown, thank you so much for being with us today, Senator.
Do it again. Thanks.
I wish you the very best. Brown.senate.gov. Check it out. You can also tweet with Senator Brown at Sen Sherrod Brown. So, and we will be right back with more on Anything Goes Friday. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Let's get an Occupy update, and we'll pick up your calls right after this. Anything goes. Frank in Cambridge, Mass. Hey, Frank, let's try this again. You're talking about the corporate takeover of the city government?
Yes, just about. In Great Barrington. Well, GE plant was in Pittsfield. They were dumping PCBs into the Housatonic River for years during Jack Welch's presidency of the GE.
Just like they were doing in the Hudson up in New York. They've been fighting that one for 20 years or so.
Yeah, exactly. Now it's coming to the court. They have different appraisals for the fix-it.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks like one of those is suggesting the GE owes $900 million. So what the GE did was they gave Business Association One Berkshire $300,000. Now this is a small community, Great Barrington, and they started flooding the newsways and the airways. And they bought out the city manager of Great Barrington, and he put on General Electric's finding on a website.
Oh, really?
And while I was reading this in the newspaper, you know, he was this guy has come under intense fire, which is another thing that the Western papers, Western Massachusetts papers, have switched from Republican to Democrat. They carry Paul Krugman, you know, and all these people, you know, which are readable, you know, these nuts that they used to carry. But anyway, well, so what happened? What is happening now is this guy has gotten two D-minus ratings by the city government.
Mm-hmm.
And they're still fighting it out. Mm-hmm. I mean, this thing, I mean, there's no end to the gall of these people.
Right.
So I don't think they're just going to walk away from it because they owe, GE might wind up owing $900 million.
Right. So buying a city councilman or buying a local chamber of commerce kind of thing for a couple hundred thousand bucks, it's just a good investment.
This guy's a city manager.
Yeah.
This guy who controls the cash.
Amazing.
You know,
he's
the guy who they hire.
Well, Frank, thanks for the heads up. I can't speak with any personal knowledge about this, so I can't endorse what you're saying, but it sounds interesting, and I'm sure that a lot of our listeners and viewers who are in your area will be looking more into it more carefully. Frank, thanks for bringing up the topic. Mark Chapman?
This is Mark Taylor Canfield. Actually.
Mark Taylor Canfield. For some reason, it's got a different name written down here. Mark Taylor Canfield, who blogs over at Huffington Post and all over the Internet from Occupy Seattle with an update about the Occupy movement. Hey, Mark, what's going on?
Well, Tom, we just had our Occupy National gathering in Philadelphia, but I want to put that in context before I give you a quick report, and that is that the two UN envoys sent a letter to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton pretty much condemning and criticizing the police crackdowns on the Occupy Wall Street movement in the United States.
We read them here on the air.
Ah, beautiful. I'm definitely glad that you guys are covering that issue. So that's sort of the backdrop, is that at this point the State Department hasn't really responded. They said that they're...
No, they won't respond. I can just tell you in advance they're not going to respond. They're going to hope that it just dies.
Well, supposedly an unnamed spokesperson, according to Dan Frumkin, said that they're... referring that to the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department. But
right.
Despite of all the predictions of its demise, you know, 1,500 people participated in person and online at the National Occupy Gathering.
Great.
And the fact that event took place at Independence Mall, the symbolism of that was not lost on people that there were activists meeting in Philadelphia on July 4th. And I actually, after I finished reporting on it as a journalist, was able to write and introduce a Declaration of Independence from Wall Street.
Hmm.
So with a lot of help from Tom Jefferson, of course,
mm-hmm.
because it's based on the original declaration, although, you know, it's not a declaration of separation from the U.S. government. Rather, it's an attempt to get the corporate influence out of our government and in saying specifically that we are the government, we are the people, and we want the corporate influence out of our government and out of our election system.
As Thomas Jefferson so often said, basically, that we are the people. Yeah.
Yeah, so I'll send you a copy of that. I mean, I'd really
love to see it.
Sure. At least we've got a few ideas to work on from here on out. And also I want to let folks know that yesterday was the last day of the conference, and there's a 100-mile march taking place right now where people are marching from Philadelphia to Wall Street to deliver what they're calling their vision of a true democracy there at Wall Street. So we'll be looking forward to them meeting with the folks at OWS on Wall Street, you know, as soon as they can make it there, and hopefully they'll pick up a lot of people along the way. So I wanted to, you know, give a shout out to those folks that are doing that. It's a very brave, courageous, and wonderful thing to do to collect your grievances and petition the people that, you know, are responsible for those things. So
agreed.
Hopefully more and more people will be doing that, Tom.
Great. Mark Taylor Canfield, blogging about the Occupy movement all over the planet. Thank you, Mark.
Thanks, Tom. Keep up the good work. Occupy the media.
There you go. We're doing it. 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, and proud to do it. Thank you. Edward in Pike County, Kentucky. Hey, Edward, what's up?
How you doing, Tom?
Fine. It says here you disagree with me. What's up?
Oh, no, I don't disagree with you.
I'm sorry. It says Dish Network. It's part of it got covered up by the... My apologies.
That's okay. I'm in East Kentucky, and, of course, Mitch McConnell... Anyway, he's going around talking about the health care bill.
Right.
And I went down toward Georgetown. He was out there, so I went out to see what he had to say,
mm-hmm.
which I know he's a nut, but I went to see him anyway.
Sure.
He after he gets done talking, he was asked what was his plans, you know, for the health care.
Mm-hmm.
You know how they do. They talk around in circles.
Mm-hmm.
And then he comes back to it, and he says, well, we need to get rid of the president in order to do something about health care. And everybody just goes wild. I mean, they just go wild.
They went wild? People liked that?
Yeah. Yo, they loved it. Tell me, nothing like it.
Yeah.
And I thought, I'm going to hang around, see what's going on, you know, talk to somebody.
Yeah.
So I stand around. And most people down there work in the factories.
Yeah.
A lot of people are retired. They go down there because their kids went down there and had kids. So I'm talking to a few of them, and it's, you tell them, ask them why they're going to vote for Romney or whatever, and they say what. Anyway, you say, well, he's not going to help you. He's against Medicare, Medicaid. He's going to take your Social Security. And they get so mad when you tell them that. They lose it.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It is. Edward, I respect you for going to a Mitch McConnell rally. Good on you. And telling the truth to people. Keep doing it. More of us need to be doing it. Thank you for the call. And, you know, he may be a dummy, but he's your representative.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Boy, it'd be tough having Mitch McConnell represent me in Congress. I've had some odd ones, but that would be right up at the top of the list. We'll be right back. Anything Goes Friday.
I need a big weekend.
Welcome back. Okay, I got to check the chat room, too, on this thing and see what people are saying, because I've got somebody. Let's see. How do you get $100 million in your 401k? The Wall Street Journal accounted for this. This is the question. Mitt Romney has $100 million in his 401k, and I thought it was a $6,000 annual contribution. Somebody sent me a note saying that the max was $17,000 in 1995. It was $9,250. But still, that doesn't add up to $100 million. The Wall Street Journal said he made good investment decisions. He's a really brilliant investor. He made more than 50 times the return that the best money managers on earth have ever produced, ever, and did it consistently every year for 20 years in a row. And Bain matched his contribution by 5,000%. They put $2.2 million each into his 401k. Then with 8% return per annum and no down years, during the tech bubble or the bank crash, he would have had $117 million in his tax-deferred account. Right. Well, I just think things like this. I just saw an op-ed by what's Justin's last name? The guy who's who runs MoveOn.org, Justin Rubin, I think. And in which he's there, you know, Mitt Romney, the Koch brothers, one of the Koch brothers is throwing a $50,000 plate fundraiser for Mitt Romney this weekend at the Hamptons. And MoveOn.org is going to be there. They're going to meet his limousine, and they're going to have the 99% airline, which is a little plane that pulls a banner, flying around the top with a banner that says, Romney has a Koch problem. Wah, wah, wah. No, seriously, they're going to do that. I think it's great. So, anyway, David in Chicago. Hey, David, what's up?
Hi, I'm glad you had Senator Brown on to talk about trade. And I brought up this issue before, but what seems to be lacking in the whole trade discussion is how these guest worker visa programs are negotiated as part of these trade
agreements.
Deals.
Yeah.
And I just want to put a number on it. The latest jobs number, I believe, was 80,000 for this past month.
Right.
Well, our government gave out 34,000 green cards. How are we going to be
this
serious?
Last month?
This past month.
Wow.
Half of those jobs went to foreign workers. This is insane. And let me put even a finer point on it. Bain Capital owns a company called Sensata in Freeport, Illinois. And right now they brought over Chinese workers on visas to force the American workers to train them so they can learn the jobs and then ship them back to China. And this is happening as we're speaking right now. Sensata, S-E-N-S-A-T-A.
Wow.
So if you want to understand how guest workers visa programs and green cards work with offshoring, read Ron Hira's prospect.org story in August 2007, how guest workers promote outsourcing.
Okay, got it.
And read Lori Wallach's story in March of 2006, debunking the myth of Mode 4 and the U.S. H-1B visa program.
Oh, Lori's been all over this forever. Next week, we're doing a full half hour with her on our TV show in our Conversations with the Great Minds next Friday, a week from Friday.
And Tom, this is important because this TPP trade deal is occurring.
Is insane.
It's behind closed doors, and we have to watch to make sure they don't smuggle in another special guest worker visa program like they've already done for Singapore and Australia and get around the H-1B visa cap by doing unilateral trade deals with India and China and these other countries.
David, I'm totally with you. Thank you for calling and raising the issue. Russ in Portland. Hey, Russ, what's up? Thanks for listening to KPOJ.
Thanks, Tom. Hi. I wanted to speak about the IRA contributions, and I understand that the New York Times may have already explained away exactly how he's able to do that.
Well, it was the Wall Street Journal, and they didn't quite explain it, because what they said was that he was 50 times more successful than the best money managers on earth every year for 20 years. I don't buy that.
Yeah, well, I can't speak to how exactly successful that he is. All that I know is that I went online, the IRS website, looked up retirement topics about contribution limits to the IRA.
Mm-hmm.
And it does, in fact, say that $6,000 is a limit, but then it goes on further down the page, talking about the taxes on excess IRA contributions.
Right.
So you can contribute to your IRA, but that excess is taxed at 6% per year as long as the excess remains in the IRA.
Ah, so this, and Romney's not paying that tax, which is probably why his 401k is in the Bahamas or Bermuda or Caymans or something like that.
That might be the case. I'm not really up on the intricacies.
Yeah.
You can also avoid that tax.
Mm-hmm.
Just on the website, it says if you either withdraw the excess that you contributed that year, which he obviously hasn't done,
right,
or two, withdraw any income earned on the excess contribution
and pay tax on it. But he's not doing that. I mean,
so
his total his total tax last year was 13.9%. His federal income tax. I mean, on what, $23 million or something that he made. I mean, I don't think he's doing that. I'm still trying to figure it out. Russ, thank you for the call. Jim in Welcome, Maryland. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Mr. Hartman, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for listening to We Act Radio.
Associated with the U.S. Postal Service, I know you're opposed staunchly to downsizing the U.S. Postal Service. But I've asked a lot of people like yourself who have never worked for the Postal Service why it shouldn't be downsized. And, of course, your answer is it was the legislator mandating future retirement benefits for the postal workers. And that's what's put the whole thing in jeopardy. But I've talked to many union postal workers what they think about that. They concede there is a loss of need for the USPS because of loss of first-class mail and loss of package delivery because of competition from FedEx.
If that's the case, Jim, you know, it sounds like you're reading something here, but if that's the case, then why was it that before...
I wrote everything down, Tom.
Okay, that's fine. Let me just... Jim, you know, I let you get a couple sentences out. Let me get me one out anyway here. If that's the case, why was it before that 2006 law was passed by the Bush administration that said that the Postal Service, unique among all government agencies and all corporations in the history of the world, had to set aside $5 billion a year to pay for the retirement, the health retirement benefits of people who retire 75 years from now? Why was it that before that $5 billion a year requirement was stuck in there in 2006, that the Postal Service was not only profitable, but so profitable that they were talking about replacing up to half of their entire fleet of small vehicles with solar-powered vehicles?
I worked for the U.S. Postal Service, and we did not disagree with that mandatory legislation, and we did not strike.
I don't think anybody knew what was in it.
Okay, but everybody now that I'm talking to postal workers now, many of them veterans, and many of them can retire at any time, they're not complaining about their retirement benefits being mandatory. They like that they're going to be taken care of in their future years.
Yeah. Jim, I strongly thank you for your call, but I can tell you, you know, we've had representatives of the Postal Workers Union on this program before. You do not speak for the vast majority of postal workers. And the reason why conservatives are going after postal workers and after the post office is because it is the largest single employer repository of unionized employees in the United States. The largest employer in the United States is Walmart. It is not unionized. The second largest employer in the United States is the United States Postal Service. It is unionized. The right wing can't stand that. And that's why in 2006, George W. Bush and the Republicans decided to take a bite out of the butt of the post office, and they've been very successful at doing it. Matt in Louisville, Kentucky. Hey, Matt, what's up?
Great. I've got it for you.
What, Romney's IRA?
I did a little more research after thinking about this, but, excuse me. I learned in a real estate class that you can, people think of IRA investments and you think stocks, bonds, you know, that kind of good stuff.
Sure.
What a lot of people don't realize, excuse me, is that you can use it for investments of all kinds. You can invest in real estate, you can invest in businesses, all that kind of good stuff. So,
right.
So what I plan
as long as it's not more than $6,000, otherwise you have to start paying taxes on it.
Well, consider this. If it tap dances the line between illegal and just taking advantage of loopholes, but you can basically what I'm thinking Romney has done here is that it has a lot to do with the fact that it's not present value but future value.
Mm-hmm.
When talking about an IRA, the present value is what matters. So.
Well, he's claiming the present value of his IRA or his 401k is $100 million.
Correct.
So how do you do that at $6,000 a year?
He takes $100 out of his IRA and makes an investment with it and goes into a partnership with a buddy or whatever. They create a company with this $100, you know, sort of filing.
A company that's worth $50 million. With this
$100. They make record profits.
Right, right. But see, he would have to make more profit than pretty much anybody on earth has ever made. I mean, it's just, they did shut down a lot of companies and they did rip off a lot of companies. So maybe that's how they did it. Matt, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I mean, how many people's pensions would Mitt Romney have to steal to put $100 million in his 401k? Just ask him.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them blue for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, our associate producer, Shane Farnan, our video director, Jim Javinsky, our phone screeners, Paul Edney and Rain Koch, to writer-researcher Sam Sachs, Alva Goldbook for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, to Ron Hartenbaum at WYD, to all the various companies that syndicate our program, Dial Global, Pacifica Radio, Free Speech TV, on Dish Network, DirecTV, all the cable providers who carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Networks, all the others around the country, all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, and to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, and the folks in our chat room, to Ellen Ratner and Victoria Jones, and all the great folks at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you. Seriously, thank you. Rose in Anaheim, California. Hey, Rose, what's on your mind today?
No, on my mind is that Stericycle. Have you heard about it?
Yeah, it's the company that disposes of medical waste, including fetuses, that
did
Bain
Romney
Capital invested in.
Romney invested money in it?
Well, what the Romney campaign is saying is that investment was made in late 1999 and that in early 1999 he went off to run the Olympics. Now, what people on the other side are saying, and there's a really good piece on July 4th or July 5th written about this, I think it was over at Alternet, is that actually Romney's signature is on the documents. He was continuing.
That's what I heard.
Yeah.
That's why I'm calling you to find out if anybody's talking about it or it's not worth it or what.
Well, the right wing will not go near it because just the whole idea that Romney, you know, one of his investments was a company that disposes of aborted fetuses is,
right.
You know, makes them insane. So they're not going to go there. And
what about the other side?
Well, the other side is right here. I'm acknowledging it, but there is this is close to kind of a cheap shot because it does look like this happened after Romney was, you know, he was still at Bain technically and legally and probably on weekends was signing documents and paperwork and things, but he didn't, as far as I can tell, he didn't put this deal together. Although, I mean, you know, it's not inconceivable that he did. There's a lot of confusion around it. It's the kind of thing I'd like to see more coverage of in the national media, not because it's a gotcha, because I'd like to see it enlightened. You know, I'd like to see some light rather than just heat. I can't.
Me too, because, you know, he's over there bragging about how he's not for abortion and all this other stuff.
Yeah.
And then you hear this thing.
Well, he used to be in favor of abortion, or at least he used to be in favor of a woman's right to choose an abortion. Now he's opposed to abortion or opposed to a woman's right to choose an abortion. Mitt Romney, I mean, you know, he was for Romney Care being a tax before he was opposed to it being a tax.
Oh.
And now he's for it being a tax again. Except that not Romney Care, but Obamacare. Except that Obamacare is Romney Care. So go figure. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. Rose, thank you for the call. Steve in Phoenix. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, Tom. It sounds like you kind of, one of your people in the chat room figured out the 401 contribution limits. I think you were referring it to a 401 with a maximum of 6,000.
Right.
A 401 in 2012, you can do 17,000.
Okay.
And then there's a $5,500 catch up if you're over 55. But an IRA is 5,000 and another 1,000 if you're 50. And that brings the 6,000. But nonetheless, I don't know how he was able to work these numbers because, you know, he'd have to be better than, you know, Templeton or any of these, great investors.
He'd have to make Warren Buffett look like a bozo.
Oh, there's hanky funny stuff. It has to be, but nonetheless, can I ask you a question about this toxoplasmosis?
Yeah, the cat stuff that I was talking about yesterday.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah. You know, I know you've got your Higgins and stuff, and he was a rescue cat, and
yeah,
our cat we had to put down in December because she was a rescue cat, and we
sorry
had
to hear that.
And I've got asthma. But is this a disease that it pertains to outdoor cats or indoor cats, or is there any differentiation?
The Toxoplasmosis gondii is a parasite that has multiple pieces to its life cycle that routinely infects cats and very often infects people, and 99% of the time, or very high percentage of the time, it causes no symptoms in either one. The big problem for toxoplasmosis, and this has been widely known for years and years, is that if a baby is born with it or infected in utero, it can cause birth defects. And so there's been all this concern, and most pregnant women know this. They're told this by their obgyns. Don't, you know, handle kitty litter. You know, wash your hands after you handle a cat, things like that, because you don't want to get that infection when you're pregnant. And you don't want your baby to get it during the first few days or first few weeks of life. This study that was done on nurses in Denmark that showed a correlation between antibodies for toxoplasmosis and suicide and the rate of suicide is, you know, got a lot of people scratching their heads. Nobody's sure what the mechanism of causation is. And it hasn't been done on men. The same study hasn't been done on men yet, so we don't know. Presumably it would affect men the same way. But there's a lot of things out there that are nasty for you. I mean, you know, high fructose corn syrup. It's like,
oh, yeah,
you know,
I'm severely allergic to that.
Yeah, there's no shortage of stuff to be concerned about. With our cats, you know, we're careful. You know, you wash your hands and cats are, what's the old saying? Cats are really clean. They're covered with cat spit. But Steve, I wouldn't obsess about it or worry about it. And if you want to, you can always go to your doctor, and it's a simple blood test to see if you're carrying the parasite. Thanks a lot for the call. Coming up next on the Tom Hartman program, I'll have a rumble with Daniel Halper of the Weekly Standard. Who's really responsible for the low job numbers? Plus, we'll have the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman program, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week for We the People. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. Get out there and occupy something. Tag, you're it. See you Monday.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.